Now, did you notice how the children's hymn and the last piece by the Fumbling Fingers Band told a story? The gospel story? Poetically phrased, but the story nonetheless. I think that Christianity is at the bottom a story. This week I read an essay by Dan Hayward, a minister from Ottawa Presbytery who was ordained this spring, an essay for which he won a prize. And I read the essay, and I remembered the feeling of intellectual excitement of producing a well-reasoned theology paper. I used to try when I was a student. And when you preach, you try to do a careful exegesis. That is, a careful interpretation of the text. So you read commentaries and you think about it and you drink it all in. But when one has probed the best minds that one can find as deeply as one can, then, as one of my favorite authors, Frederick Buechner, put it, you are forced to take off your glasses and push your books off to one side and say, once upon a time. Now, this is how the story went in Jesus' day. And this is what the Jewish people believed at the time. It began with creation, as you heard. You moved on the waters. You called to the deep. You coaxed up the mountains from valleys of sleep. Whether it's a call or whether it's a song that the Creator sings, it's an invitation to all of creation to a relationship between God and the creatures that He has made. And when God was rejected the first time, God started over. And when that new start also proved a failure, He began anew with one man among many, Abraham, and He promised him an inheritance and an heir if he would be faithful. And he was. As I said, his name was Abraham. And through him came Isaac, and then Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. And through his 12 sons came the 12 tribes of a new nation, who were delivered from slavery in Egypt and brought once again to the promised land. There were promises and detours, triumphs and tragedies, a kingdom and then a kingdom divided. The Assyrians conquered the north and the Babylonians conquered the south, and they were taken into exile. And so it looked again that maybe all was lost. And through it all, God spoke through the prophets to open their eyes, to open their eyes to their unfaithfulness and their willingness to believe lies and to turn to idols, and to His continuing faithfulness to them. And then a remnant of exiles returned to the land, and they worked to rebuild Israel, and seizing on the words of their prophets, nourishing the hope that one day, a king would take the throne and restore the nation to its former glory. His name would be Messiah, meaning the Anointed One. That was the story. That was the faith that the disciples were living with. And they believe that Jesus was that king. As they witnessed His life, the crowds and the miracles, they became more and more convinced that He was the one that all Israel was waiting for all these years. And if He was the one, then all their dreams would be coming true. He would come to Jerusalem in triumph. He would drive out the Romans. And surely those who had stuck with Him from the beginning would get privileged positions in His new regime. You would think so. Can you see that if this was their story, if this was their understanding of their faith, how very, very difficult it would be to accommodate the idea of a crucified Messiah? Where does it fit in that story? The Messiah was supposed to offer the ultimate guide to personal and national success. He was supposed to be mourning in Jerusalem, like mourning in America. It was not supposed to be, as it turned out, darkness at noon. Having already heard two predictions of his death, they were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, says our text today. And the disciples were astonished, while those who followed him were afraid. A third and more detailed prediction of his death follows. Astonished and afraid. I thought about that a lot. What can happen when we get news that shatters our world, our plans, our hopes, is that we enter into a kind of state of denial. We can reject the news out of hand, as in, oh, that just can't be true. Or, he didn't really mean that. Sometimes the behavior of someone in denial is inappropriate, maybe even bizarre. Perhaps you've witnessed it. I have. I've seen people in denial. They seem to say things that just don't fit with the circumstances. At that point, for the disciples to reconstruct their whole framework to include a crucified Messiah was absolutely beyond them. So they opted for denial, and they moved ahead with their assumptions. So we have the strange question, put by the two brothers for permission to sit at Jesus' left and right sides in his glory. And of course, the indignant outcry from the others when they hear that James and John, what they were up to. And probably because they didn't get there first, really. Now, there's no doubt that the picture that Mark paints of the disciples, both in our text and throughout his whole gospel, is not a flattering one. They are always, always failing to get it. You see, the gospel really is something that will turn all our worlds upside down, whatever era we live in, if we let it, if we let the story be spoken. Now, today I'm wondering about us. Now, some of you may be here to please someone else or to help keep peace in the family. You know, but by and large, I think we're here because we want to be somewhere in the story, or at least giving it some very serious thought. There are many of you who have embraced this story with your whole selves, and you felt in turn that you have been embraced by its Lord. For you, it's been what someone called, I love the phrase, a long obedience in the same direction. But there are many others of us who seem to hesitate at wholehearted commitment. Even those who have worshipped here almost their whole adult lives and wonder at the end if it's true, this gospel story. It's never been easy to believe and to follow in the way of Jesus. As Chesterton told us, it is not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting. It is that it's been found hard and thus not tried by many. It seems to me that we have particular fears today. So what are we afraid of? I think we're afraid that all the truly intelligent, urbane, and sophisticated people are somewhere else this morning. While you and I, along with the Pentecostals and the Bible thumpers and poor, benighted souls that we are still clinging to what a group of theologians once called the myth of God incarnate. Years ago, I read a book by a German theologian commenting on the religious situation in Europe, and he began his book by saying that it used to be that the church wrote apologetics, that is, defense of the faith, for those outside the faith. Now, he said, We must defend the faith to those inside the church. I think these 30 years or so after he wrote the book, we face, of course, a very similar situation within the churches in North America. The same skepticism that permeates society has found a home in our churches. The sad thing is when we try to provide opportunities here at Parkdale for discussion, for question, for musings, and yes, for defense of the faith, very few take the advantage of it. Perhaps 30 to 40 people at the most come to the Bible study, Jesus 24/7, other faith formation opportunities. Now, I've spoken on the subject of doubt several times, so I'm not going to be more fulsome about that today. But I can just say that when I find myself doubting the story, and I do, who wouldn't? I just remember the company I'm in. People like Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury, who several British people have said is probably the brightest mind in Britain. He believes this story with his whole heart. N.T. Wright. I hear so much about the Jesus Seminar and the current crop of New Testament people. And I can tell you that N.T. Wright, who's also an Anglican bishop, used to be dean of Westminster Abbey, is without doubt, I think, one of the best New Testament scholars alive today. And he believes it with his whole heart. Barack Obama decided to become a Christian as an adult. He was baptized. We're in good company, those who struggle to believe. What are we afraid of? I think we're afraid of we're going to miss something. Something somewhere else, or our children are. We have an amazing number of people here who just drop in from time to time when they have nothing better to do on a Sunday. Classes in our Sunday school can have 5 children one week and 5 completely different children the next week. And you know, even if our children were here every single Sunday, they would receive 37 hours of teaching in a year. That's 1.5 school weeks. Janet Neal, who was a Christian Ed person at Glebe St. James for more than 15 years. She's a gifted artist, she's a teacher, a dramatist, and a curriculum specialist. Someone who put her whole heart into the Sunday school said recently that people used to disappear for the hockey season or the ski season, and then they would be back. But now they seldom are, except for special occasions. You know, we crowd more and more into our lives so that we ultimately become samplers of many things with very little time to focus on what really, really matters. I know, as we all do, there's no assistance from the culture to clear a way for any sort of Sabbath keeping that would make us all healthier and happy people. I know that the stores are open 7 days a week, that our jobs take place on Sundays, that Sundays are a favorite day for birthday parties for younger children, and games of all kinds are scheduled on this day. At the root of it all is our unwillingness to commit wholeheartedly to the claims that God has on our lives, the lives of those who bear Christ's name, and to take seriously our responsibility to ensure that we and our children will really know this story. Does God mean more to you than a pious extra to your life, a final polish, as it were, on your already good life? I think that was the question that Jesus was asking the rich man in last week's story. It's like if you put everything that you treasure and value in your life on the left pan of an old-fashioned scale, and into that pan goes all that pertains to your lifestyle on which you depend. And in addition, you put your friendships and your social standing and your talents, and then put the weight that God has in your life on the right-hand pan. And then watch which side it is that sinks. A farmer who had just retrieved a lost sheep was asked, how do sheep wander away? And this is what the farmer said. They just go from one tuft of grass to another until at last they've lost their way. Unless we consciously choose our walk with God as our first priority, then we are apt to nibble ourselves lost. And whatever we nibble will be what we become. Now I know that I've sounded awfully preachy this morning. I want you to know that I am myself a target for this text. It's the same kind of challenge for me as it is for each of you. And there is good news, as there's always meant to be. Curiously, as I was thinking about what I've said this morning, as you know, Anthony often talks about how, with the text going around in your mind through the week, you sort of see a whole lot of things through that lens. Well, I was listening to Leonard Cohen live in London, his CD, this week. And he sings, as only Leonard can, "Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There are cracks in everything. That's how the light gets in." There are cracks in all of us. There's cracks in you and there's cracks in me. Our faith is not perfect. Forget trying to be perfect. Forget there is no perfect offering. However, there are bells that still ring. The bell that still rings is Jesus' faith in us. You see, even to these scared and selfish disciples who just didn't get it, he was actually able to say on the same occasion, "You will drink the cup I drink. You will be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with." God still has faith in us. We are the only hands and feet, the only voice he has. And the bell still rings with the truth that Christ came to set us free from all that would enslave us, to set us free to give ourselves to God and to his dream for the world. The person who is converted to Christ is the new human being, wrote Oscar Romero, the martyred bishop. It's the new human being that society needs to organize a world according to God's heart. In that venture to which God calls us, God will use all our skills, all our abilities, all our gifts and graces, all our friendships, all our personalities. These will not be diminished, I promise you, but by be transformed by God's Spirit to be so much more than we could ever be had we kept all these things to ourselves. Had we only remained nibbling away at all kinds of things. I promise you that. Amen.